So I am happy to introduce Annie Stilts. Annie has recently published a book which is called Liberal Loyalty, Freedom, Obligation, and the State. She teaches at Princeton University and was previously teaching at Columbia. So please.
Great, thanks. So my paper is called Provisional Right and Past Injustice. And I guess just maybe more informally, I'll say something about why I wrote this paper. I've been working a little bit on rights to territory, but in a kind of more normative, analytical style vein. And the theory that I sort of put forward about rights to territory was a broadly kind of statist theory, so that it was states that have rights to jurisdiction over territory, and then individuals' rights to property are kind of derived from this prior collective right of the state and jurisdiction. And I sort of developed that view from kind of broadly Kantian sort of premises, although it wasn't like an interpretive project on Kant. But one kind of objection I got to my views when I would sort of present them around was the objection of non-state peoples, what to do about them. And so I got interested in, well, what Kant said about them and how he handled this problem. And I decided to kind of actually just engage that a bit more through a more interpretive paper. So I start from the paper from the kind of beginning thought that Kant's anti-imperialism, which has been emphasized, I think, really nicely in recent work by Sankar and by Peter, it's fairly surprising, given his general theory of property and territory, that he takes this anti-imperialist stance. And that's because, I think, given his more general views about the relationship between property and political authority, one would think that non-state peoples would have a fairly tenuous legal standing in a Kantian world. And there are kind of two reasons that one would think this. One is that non-state peoples, they're not subjects of international right. And because they're not states, they lack an internal constitution. And so that means they're not protected under its provisions against annexation or intervention. They just don't enjoy that protection. And the second reason why you think non-state peoples would have this tenuous status is that Kant takes the general view that conclusive property rights can only be acquired by submission to political authority. So given that non-state peoples lack public authority, it's sort of unclear what kind of title they have to their territory, since it's obviously not a conclusive one. So that tenuous legal standing under at least the domestic and international parts of right raises a bunch of questions about how we're supposed to treat non-state peoples. Traditional questions that have come up a lot in kind of history. So can we take their land, since they might lack conclusive title to it? Can we force them to construct states? Can we coercively annex them by incorporating them into our own state? Well, the addition of cosmopolitan right helps to answer these questions. Because it's the one aspect of right that grants non-state people some degree of legal standing where the other forms of right don't. And the first section of the paper kind of goes through cosmopolitan right in some detail. I'm not really going to recapitulate that now because I think we've done enough discussing of the content of cosmopolitan right. But I would emphasize a couple of prerogatives that it grants non-state peoples that I think are important. One is that it grants non-state peoples the right to exclude foreigners from their territories should they wish to refuse society or trade with those people, with those foreigners. And reciprocally, it places foreigners under duties with respect to non-state peoples. And I think that these duties are even more robust when it comes to a non-state people than when it comes to a state like China or Japan that might refuse interaction. When it comes to a state, the foreigner's duty is to leave the territory, it seems, if interaction has been refused. But when it comes to a non-state people, it seems the foreigner's duty is even more robust than that. It's a duty of something like non-encroachment. So it's not just kind of leaving, but actually being careful about engaging in practices that might subvert non-state people's control over their territory, like appropriating land nearby, or signing a contract with them using concepts they don't understand, or interfering with their hunting or nomadic practices. So I guess the strategy of the paper is pretty much to kind of try to reread the general theory of property and territory In light of Kant's view that non-state peoples have this fairly robust right to exclude foreigners from their territory. So I want to know what this tells us about Kant's theory of property and territory sort of more broadly, if we kind of take this as a central plank in our interpretation. And in particular, I think this raises the issue of what's the relationship of provisional claims to property that we might make in a state of nature to more conclusive claims that Kant says we would get under a civil authority, because the non-state people is going to at best have a provisional claim. And at in the last section of the paper, I raised the issue of what happens when we violate provisional claims. So non-state peoples in the world we know today, in settler societies, their provisional claims have been violated in the past. And can we, do we just have to let bygones be bygones about that, or is there some weight that a provisional claim can carry forward into the future in terms of allowing a society to address a historic injustice? So I think I made kind of three arguments in the paper. The first argument is that the reason why non-state peoples can exclude foreigners from their land is because they have a provisional right of something like ownership in their territory. And that's going to be kind of controversial reading of why. The second thing that I claim is that I ask the question, what does a provisional right entail? And does that mean that non-state peoples have some sort of less robust right than a European state would in their territory? And I give an account of what's involved in a provisional right that emphasizes the idea of particularity, the idea that provisional rights place us under genuine obligations, and the idea that it entails a kind of duty to cooperate in founding political authority. And in the last section of the paper, I asked whether provisional rights can sort of provide a guide to redressing historic injustice, and a kind of sketch of view that says maybe they can in a sort of limited way. Okay, so let me sort of talk about the first thing, why non-state peoples can exclude. And here I sort of argue against a view that I'm now worried I might have kind of wrongly associated with Sankar and Peter, to the effect that maybe the rules of right don't really apply to non-state peoples in the most full-blown way, because non-state peoples either don't really appropriate or don't make use of their land in the ways that would require them to enter civil relations. And I think that non-state peoples do actually appropriate their territory under a kind of Kantian conditions, and that by extension they are morally required to set up a state, even though this kind of moral requirement is not one that foreigners have title to enforce. So let me give two reasons why I think non-state peoples do have something like provisional ownership in their territory. The first set of reasons is kind of a Kantian interpretive reasons, given what Kant says in his book. The second set of reasons is empirical reasons about what non-state peoples were like at the time of first contact with Europeans. So for Kant, as I read him, appropriation is a fairly minimal claim. It's a claim to what he calls intelligible possession. And what's involved in that claim is that I raise a claim to possess an object that I'm not necessarily currently holding or physically connected to. So all I really have to do is claim that something can be mine even when I put it down or left it, such that I believe I can exclude other people from it and believe that I would be wronged by their unauthorized use of it. And I think that's just a very thin concept of appropriation. So against any sort of Lockean view, Kant does not add a further requirement that one has to cultivate or enclose or transform or build on a piece of land to appropriate it. All one has to do is raise this kind of intelligible claim to exclusive use. And he suggests that one could do that by being the first claimant and giving just a sign of one's will to possess it, and that sign could take many, many forms. Kant also suggests that original acquisition of a permanent place on the earth, of a piece of land to be your kind of permanent residence, is a form of appropriation. So it would seem like an acquisition of a territory would be a form of appropriation for Kant. And my last sort of textual piece of evidence for this is that I think that there's evidence that Kant is quite happy to countenance collective ownership arrangements. So the passage about Mongolia that we've mentioned a few times, where he says the land belongs to all the people, and that means somebody can leave his pack on it or recover his horse, even though they don't have individual property rights in Mongolia. And he doesn't seem to have a problem with that. Okay, so those are my Kantian reasons for thinking maybe non-state peoples own their territory. My empirical reasons are, as a matter of fact, many non-state peoples, and I use the example of the Amerindians east of the Mississippi here, made what I think were perfectly recognizable claims to property and territory, though the form of their property systems was different than European property systems. So for one thing, tribes claimed distinct territories that everyone recognized as marked out by certain natural boundaries. And they would take an incursion by a neighboring tribe into their territory to be, you know, a violation of their exclusive right to use that territory, even though they might not have used those words. Another thing is that in the east of the Mississippi, most Indian tribes were agricultural, at least to some degree. And so within a tribe, they actually allocated usufruct rights to individuals in separate agricultural plots. So if you were an individual member of an Indian tribe, you would have had a right to your dwelling against your fellow tribe members, and you would have had a right to your plot against your fellow tribe members. And so I think that's definitely recognizable on sort of broadly Kantian grounds as claims of intelligible possession. So I think, you know, weighing up this evidence in general, it supports the view that non-state peoples do make claims to provisional ownership. But I think that also is going to mean that they're under duties to submit to political authority. So because they claim intelligible rights vis-a-vis their fellow tribe members, they're under a duty to submit to domestic authority. And because they claim territorial rights vis-a-vis other neighboring peoples, they're under a duty, like all states are, to submit to international institutions. And I sketch a reason why I think Kant says we can't permissibly enforce that duty as a kind of foreigner. Which has to do with the inevitability of interaction. And I think, Lisbeth, you've kind of raised similar considerations that I was sympathetic to. I think we only have a duty to enforce our rights by forcing other people into a state when our independence is threatened by the people around us, by the lack of a state. And in cases where our interaction with those people is purely voluntary, we don't have to be where we are. We just came over here for, you know, reasons of discovery or plunder, but we could sort of happily stay back in Europe, property and rights intact. That doesn't generate this authorization to coerce other people that might be generated if we were unavoidably where we are. But it's consistent with that to think that Indians have duties to people that are unavoidably there with them, but maybe not to a foreign colonist, to set up a state. And that, you know, someone who kind of got the idea of a state and decided that one needed to be introduced, who was there unavoidably, might have the right to introduce it. I just leave that open. It's certainly consistently possible, I think. So that's kind of my first thing. I think the reason why non-state peoples can exclude is because they are provisional owners of their territory. Okay. So second, well, what does it mean to have a provisional claim to your territory? And that sounds kind of like a weak claim to your territory. Does that mean that non-state peoples have a less robust right than an individual property owner or a state would, a European state? And this is actually of significant interest because there, you know, in the history of thinking about Aboriginal property rights, there's this thing that's been invented which is called Aboriginal title. Which is something like an occupancy right, which is supposed to be like a weaker form of right that many countries extended to their Aboriginal inhabitants. So what is Kant's view on this sort of question? I think we should begin in thinking about what provisional... Here I kind of open up the bigger question of what are provisional rights like for Kant? And I think that, I guess my interpretive strategy here is to think of cosmopolitan right and the idea that foreigners ought to respect non-state people's claims to their territory as a kind of important interpretive insight into how we should think about provisional rights when we think about what they're like. I think that means they're not radically indeterminate rights. Instead, they have moral content and they make certain demands on us even in a state of nature. So the reason why a right to property in the state of nature is provisional for Kant is that unilateral appropriation of property and territory is prima facie wrong for Kant. He thinks that it's wrong to unilaterally appropriate property and territory And that's because when I unilaterally stake a claim to something, I'm trying to make my will a law for all of you out there, right? So before I unilaterally staked my claim to this room, say, you guys could use the room whenever my body wasn't occupying it, but now I put up stakes around it and I give a sign and I attempt to defend it and I say, now all of you have this new obligation you didn't have before to stay out of this room, just because I willed it to be so. Now Kant says everyone has an innate right to be free from constraint by other people's arbitrary wills, but obviously I'm infringing that innate right whenever I unilaterally try to put them under an obligation. So unilateral property claims are prima facie wrongful for Kant. Nevertheless, Kant thinks we should go ahead and make them, and he says that there's something like called a permissive law in favor of unilateral appropriation. And he gives two reasons why there is this permissive law. One is because appropriation greatly increases the scope of our freedom. When I can claim a permanent place on the earth, I can do a lot of things I couldn't do otherwise. And he also says it's a first step toward the civil condition. So it starts the process of legalizing the state of nature. But there's a serious question about what sort of right I can create by a unilateral appropriation. It's a provisional right, but how determinate is that claim? And does it bear any relationship to the conclusive rights that Kant thinks will be ushered in later by a civil condition? And most importantly, do all of you have some reason to respect my unilateral claim that I stake, given that it infringes your freedom? This issue is not just an issue with respect to non-state peoples, although it's particularly pressing there. It's also an issue with really all claims to property and territory in the world as we know it. Because Kant says that all such claims are going to be provisional until an international federation is established. So conclusive property rights are only going to kind of be ushered on the scene once we get the entire human race sort of into a federation of republics. So that means my property rights vis-a-vis my fellow citizens are sort of provisional because there might be reforms in our state that are needed to kind of get it to a perfect republic. And my state's right to its territory is provisional vis-a-vis other states out there because we don't have an international institution yet. So kind of, it's provisionality all the way down, really. So it's very important to figure out what kind of obligations we're able to impose on other people now, given that these ideal conclusive institutions are kind of far off in the future. So this is where my more creative efforts in the paper sort of come in, and also maybe the more arguably controversial efforts come in. I sort of sketched three characteristics of a provisional right. The first important characteristic is what I call particularity. So the idea is that by unilaterally appropriating something in the state of nature and creating a provisional right to it, I create a claim not just to some sort of general share of goods, but to a particular piece of property or territory that I have invested myself in. So I've chosen this one, I've given a sign, I've attempted to defend it, I may have transformed it in other ways. Kant does raise the issue of particularity briefly in a passage where he says that there's a principle for choice by which a particular possession for each person must be able to be determined on the earth land of which we're all in some sort of more broad common possession. And he refers to the lex juridica at this point. So I take it that the idea that somehow we've got to divvy up the world into particular parcels, and we're authorized to kind of go ahead and do that unilaterally. And the fact that I did it unilaterally gives me some connection or attachment to the thing that I appropriated. So I think for that reason also, provisional rights provide some limited guidance to later political authorities at the stage where they would go about assigning conclusive claims. And the guidance they provide is with respect to this particularity issue. It tells political authorities who has a presumptive claim to which things in particular. And it puts the burden of proof, I think, on the political authority who might want to override that. It's not a dispositive claim, but it means that some good reason, some good justification would need to be given for overriding the particular attachment that I have established through unilateral appropriation in the state of nature. The second feature of provisional rights that I want to highlight is that I think they place real obligations on other subjects of right, even though they might be legitimately revisable by a political authority in the future. So I want to draw kind of hive off sort of what a political authority should do if and when it comes into being, and what the subjects of right who either are governed by that political authority or who would be governed by it were it to come into being should do, given that it, you know, given that it may not be in existence yet. So I want to say that basically the obligations of these subjects of right, they're not the same at all as the duties of a public authority. The subjects of right have to assume that whatever claims to property and territory hold now within existing institutions, they have to assume that those hold legitimately and that they're placed under obligations by them, even though they know that one day down the road, a public authority might revise them. That doesn't undermine the fact that they're now obligated. So even if those claims seem inequitable or questionable in some other respect, provisional rights hold and place others under obligation until such time as they are altered by a rightfully constituted authority. And in a situation where that authority just doesn't exist yet, well, that means we've got to work to bring it about, but we can't act like we can sort of just act in its name or think about what it might do. The authority has powers that we as subjects of right cannot have. And the third thing is that provisional rights place duties on their claimants to work to bring about, to establish rightful authorities and to comply with them. So my sort of ability to claim this thing is, you know, based on a good faith effort to cooperate to the establishment of a political authority. Okay, so those are the three characteristics of provisional rights. What are we going to do about provisional rights that got overridden in the past? And in my paper, I sort of discuss this example of the expropriation of the Black Hills from the Sioux tribe in 1877. It's a pretty well-known case, and it was also litigated in the 80s, so it's a good case for this sort of thing. But what I want to say about provisional rights is that I think that they can serve as a guide to the sovereign or the lord of the land in how to allocate property in the present. A limited guide here again, and I'll talk about limitations in a minute. But the way that they provide guidance is I think that the fact that persons or groups have historically formed attachments to property and territory that gave them a provisional right, it sort of provides a pro tanto reason for ratifying that provisional right or for restoring it where it's been overridden. So it provides a pro tanto reason for granting the person with the right some control over the object in the present. And the reason I think it gives us that kind of, is because these historical attachments that we form unilaterally, they matter a lot to our structure of goals and pursuits. We become invested in certain places that we occupy, and we kind of build our lives around being there and controlling that thing. And that is a very important consideration for how we should allocate property. Now, I don't think a provisional right is a dispositive right. All I really want to say is that this information about historical attachments is an important consideration to weigh into determining a just distribution of property. So my provisional right doesn't establish necessarily the boundaries of my claim or the duties to others that might be associated with it, nor does it mean that it could never be overridden. It's just a presumption. So it's like, I kind of visualize it as if we have a scales, and the sovereign is going to kind of use the scales to kind of weigh up how things should be distributed. There's weight on the one side of the scale already by the fact that I have a provisional right. Now, that doesn't mean that there might not be other considerations that get added to the other side that might end up balancing out the other direction. But there's a weight already in one side. Okay. So if no good reason can be offered to rebut my presumption, then the presumption should be ratified. The control of the object should lie with me. So a couple of things about the limits of this. I'm not suggesting that property rights are natural rights. The distribution of property still has to be determined by a political authority in order to bind us. I'm not suggesting that individuals can kind of refer back to history and self-enforce their own rights or something. And obviously, that would be an un-Kantian way of proceeding. All I'm suggesting is that the sovereign, in determining the general will, should consider historical information in doing that. The second thing is, I don't mean to suggest that there aren't important and perhaps extremely robust distributive limitations on property claims. So Kant himself refers to some distributive limitations, like meeting the needs of the poor, and also he suggests that we can break up entailed estates, that we can expropriate the church. So he clearly thinks some degree of redistribution is in order. And I have no problem with that. In fact, I'd probably be more open to more redistribution than Kant is. But I think even if we have very robust views about distributive justice, this historical information can still remain relevant. And it can tell us that we ought to pursue distributive justice in ways that are least disruptive to these attachments that people have to particular objects and places. So, for example, we ought to do it through taxation rather than expropriation and resettlement. And that's fairly uncontroversial. But we ought to grant people in general distributive shares that allow them to perpetuate and reflect these attachments. I think that's an important value. So, sorry, I've talked quite long. I'll try to be fast at the end. How could this help us redress a past injustice? So I take the example of this one injustice, the theft of the Black Hills from the Sioux Indians in 1877. There's a lot of bad things in the history of the Sioux, apart from the theft of the Black Hills. The Sioux were victims in at least two genocidal massacres in the 19th century at the hands of the U.S. Army, the most famously the Wounded Knee Massacre of 1890, where 340 unarmed Sioux were killed. The Sioux were also, in general, gradually forced to abandon their buffalo hunting lifestyle on the plains and were settled on reservations established by the U.S. government, where they were meant to be civilized into Christian farmers. In the meantime, they were supposed to be well treated by the U.S. government, supported while they learned a new way of life. And today, the Sioux, you know, at the end of the civilizing process, are terribly badly off. They're really one of the worst off groups in America in terms of any kind of indicators that you might look at: life expectancy, income, education, unemployment, suicide rates. So the Pine Creek, the Crow Creek and Pine Ridge Sioux reservations are the two poorest, absolute poorest counties in the United States. Okay, so but the particular claim that's of interest to us here is the theft to of the Black Hills. And what happened was that in the initial war for the West, the Sioux signed a fairly favorable treaty with the U.S. That established a reservation for them that was quite large on most of what is now South Dakota, and also allowed them to keep hunting as long as the buffalo lasted off-reservation in eastern Montana. And at the moment they signed this treaty, they agreed to relinquish their rights to all other lands on the Great Plains, and not to kind of attack the railroads and attack pioneers who were crossing the Great Plains at this time. But they also wrote in a clause that said any changes to the treaty would have to be ratified by 3/4 of the male members of the tribe. Now, a few years later, in 1873, gold was discovered in the Black Hills, and so settlers started sort of pouring in. And at first, the Grant administration, who was in power at the time, tried to kind of keep the settlers out while they went to the Sioux asking to buy the hills or to lease them. But the Sioux said no, because the hills were such sort of significance to their religion and to their culture, they wouldn't give them up. So secretly, then, the Grant administration kind of stopped keeping the settlers out, allowed them to pour in, and they kind of cooked up a pretext for war against the Sioux, which they won. And then they starved the Sioux who were remaining on the reservation by denying them rations while they presented them a new treaty ceding the Black Hills. And even after the war and the starvation, only 10% of the adult males signed the new treaty. So that violated the earlier requirement of 3/4 majority. But the U.S. Congress ratified the treaty anyway, and they just took the Black Hills. So even in some sort of purely forward-looking theory of justice, the Sioux have probably lots of claims based on their needs. They're among the poorest citizens of the Black Hills. Of the United States. And they probably have claims to more government assistance than they now receive. But is there some special reason to prefer granting them not just sort of affirmative action or government payments, but to prefer restoring their control over the Black Hills? And I think if we take provisional rights seriously in the kind of the way that I sketched earlier, I think you can ground a preference for restoring the Black Hills rather than restoring or giving them some sort of more general share of goods. I think that preference would be based in the Sioux's historical investment in the Black Hills, the continuing strength of their attachment to it, And the idea that this grounds a provisional right to it, which gives us an important pro tanto reason to give them control over it. Now, if that can be made consistent with present-day distributive concerns, then I think we ought to prefer restoring their particular claim rather than some other more general kind of way of making them better off. And I think there are ways, which I'll just end on briefly referring to a couple ways, how you might go about making this provisional right recognition consistent with present-day distributive concerns. So one thing you could do, the suit were actually awarded cash compensation in the largest sort of suit of this kind in the U.S. In 1980. There's a fascinating book about the trial. The trial went on for sort of like 60 years. It was like a Jarndyce v. Jarndyce type case. So they won in 1980, and it was sort of like this great victory, like the first time an Indian tribe had ever won something of this kind. And they refused the money. So the money, they won, $106 million, and the money is still in an account in the U.S. Treasury because they won't take it. So I think, the Sioux themselves think that there's some reason to prefer, the Black Hills to a more general share of goods. And the way you might do that is either to cede them federally owned land in the Black Hills, of which there is a good amount, or to combine this compensation payment to restructure it as a land purchasing program and allow them right of first refusal on land purchases in the area. And I think that would combine a respect for the provisional right with the issue of distributive concerns. So I've gone on kind of too long.
All right. Well, thank you very much.